Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. On today's episode, we're talking about Liverpool and the dreaded seventh season syndrome under Jurgen Klopp.
If you're in that squad for this long, it's quite hard to not become a bit apathetic and a bit and just take your foot off the gas a bit.
Antoine Griezmann and Atletico Madrid's attempt to kill Barcelona, because I do think it is a little bit humiliating to just be brought on at 60 minutes like a youngster. It's a bit. Yeah. I don't know, I find that a little bit demeaning. And as usual, we'll be leafing through the burn book. You are not wrong that this is niche. This is such a weird thing to be pissed off about. While on the bonus episode, we're taking your questions on Spurs and their future under Antonio Conte.
What would Spurs, a club that has been absolutely bereft of trophies, what would they define as success? Would it be an FA Cup?
Granit Xhaka and his development under Mikel Arteta. He doesn't really defend, he never really has, and he certainly isn't good under pressure. And of course, discussing anything but football. I said to Emma, there better be a fucking shark. And when like a giant sea monster appeared, I was like, now we're talking. Like now, yeah. I'm on board. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's episode 2. I'm Patrick Van Straten, and today, as always, I'm joined by Pete Dorman. Hi, Pete. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, as always. It's 2 of 2 so far.
Exactly, 100%.
Yeah, 100%
record. Yeah, your attendance has been excellent. I mean, if you can hear any bumping around on mics, it's because Pete is currently making a gin and tonic. I think.
Double gin and tonic, yes.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize I need to specify the size of it.
I felt somewhat underprepared last week with your Hertfordshire rum, and I only had a beer. So I brought a selection of gins this week. We're starting with a York gin, Old Tom.
Oh, lovely.
Other gins are available. And as always, a classic Fever Tree, Naturally Light, because, you know, Schweppes is for plebs.
No, I do agree. Like, look, I decided to go a little bit gentler this time. So I've got a cider, I've got Hunter's Gold, and then I've got a ranch water that I've made. So
what exactly is a ranch water?
Well, it's normally made with Topo Chico, which is like a sparkling mineral water. So you take a glug out of it, and then you add normally like a Blanco tequila, and you can add other stuff. You can add like,
I've seen some of them on the TikToks.
Yeah, on the
young people's TikToks. Yeah.
So
I didn't know that's what that was, but yeah, you take a sip out of it and then put alcohol in it. And
yeah.
Yeah.
It's less appealing when it's not in the glass bottle, but I've got sparkling water, freshly squeezed lime juice. I've actually got a bit of a pineapple liqueur in there. And then I've got tequila. So it's almost like a kind of very, very light margarita, I would say.
Right,
so but it hydrates you as you get drunk. That's the important thing.
So last week you outdid me with the Hertfordshire rum, and now I've come with a selection of gins, and you've outdone me again with this ludicrous pseudo margarita.
Is that true though? Because the jigger you're using to pour your gin is one of the ones that has a handle so that you don't get your fingers sticky.
Yes.
Whereas I did get sticky fingers making this drink. Anyway, save it for later. Save the alcohol content for the second half of the show. Because this week the podcast is going to be split into two. So there'll be this episode that goes up as the public episode, and then there'll be another episode which will be for Patreon subscribers only at the $6 tier and up. It will be clear how you get access to that. It goes through a private RSS feed, but I'll be sorting that out over the next couple of days. I promise you it will work. So today on the show, we've got quite a juicy topic to start off with. Then we've got some of your questions. And then, of course, we've got Anything But Football, the Burn Book, all your favourite segments returning after episode one. So our major talking point today is whether there's something wrong with Liverpool. They're down in eighth at the moment in the Premier League. They've got a game in hand, but even if they were to win that, it would only put them fifth. And I think everybody went into the season expecting that, okay, City might look stronger, but their closest rivals are going to be Liverpool. And they did beat Bournemouth 9-0, but they also had the draw against Palace, the draw against Fulham, the draw against Everton, that big loss against Man United, the embarrassing loss to Napoli in the Champions League, which was a real battering, and then a really narrow win over Ajax the other day. And you just kind of look at them and think something is off here. Like, I'm not alone in thinking that, right?
No, absolutely not. I absolutely love this conversation, by the way. No, I know it. This is going to be obviously a bit salty from a United fan who has been void of any, you know, success at all, any hope for the past near decade. But yeah, right. What I see from Liverpool right now is a very apathetic squad. I would describe them as apathetic.
Okay.
Currently. Particularly the likes of Trent.
Yeah.
Van Dijk. Right. So
this is a Trent thing mainly, I think.
Well, right. So coming into the season, I never actually really subscribed to the kind of mantra that Trent is bad at defending. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a bit lazy in that it wasn't his forte, but he wasn't fundamentally bad. Right. Yeah. Whereas people are making him out as if he offered nothing defensively. It's more that if you are playing Liverpool, that's a side you attack, right? That's not saying he's a bad defender. It's just saying that of that back four, he is the weakest in defense, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And I think people get carried away with being like, oh, he can only go forward, he's awful at defending. But particularly in the Napoli game, right? Okay, so against United, Liverpool across the board were pretty bad.
Yeah.
But in the Napoli game, there were some incredibly like visceral moments that showed an immense amount of apathy, particularly from Trent.
The one where a guy, I think it was Kvaratskhelia, right, knocks it past him and Trent like stops, instantly stops. And then you're looking, and then later on in the move, you see him start jogging again. Yeah. And it's like he's realized, oh, actually, I should be in position by now. And if he'd been running all along, he would have been in position to stop that goal happening.
And then there's the other one where it's kind of like a 1-2 on the edge of the box and Trent is kind of like, he's tucked in a bit more in a kind of like a centre-back area at the edge of the box. But a 1-2 and he just watches it get passed into the like right-hand side of the box, passed across and tapped in. And he's just kind of standing there being like, cool. And also, to be fair, I think Fabinho also is.
Yeah. But Fabinho's body language, like, is a lot better. Like, you don't necessarily want to get into that whole thing, you know, like the creeps who watch the Queen's funeral and start like telling you about the relationship between Harry and William. But it is impossible when you watch it not to feel like Trent basically thinks that defending is beneath him. I think too much is made of the Van Dijk stuff, you know, the hands behind his back kind of thing.
Well,
I think that's
United.
Just how
in
the Napoli game as well. I mean, you get taught to do that. I get it. I don't particularly like it, but I understand why you do it because you do get penalised if it hits your hand.
It wasn't so much hand behind the back. Well, particularly with the Jadon Sancho United one.
Sure.
James Milner goes, tries to close him down, commits, gets taken out of the game. Fine. Mm-hmm. Van Dijk just stands there 4 yards away from him. In the middle of the box, by the way, like he's on the edge of a 6-yard box. He doesn't press him. He just kind of stands there and lets him take a shot.
Sure, but I think
it's just Van Dijk just wasn't as switched on as he should have been at that point.
Yeah. I think the thing about Van Dijk is, though, Van Dijk has such an unconventional defending style because he has always been much stronger and faster and better at reading the play than everybody around him. And so you do see Van Dijk do stuff quite often, like he waits really late to engage, right? He always waits till the last minute before doing something. Whereas you see other defenders who are kind of more conventional will steam up to a player and immediately try and do something. Van Dijk just doesn't do that. But I thought the irony about Milner going and bollocking Van Dijk after that was that I thought the problem in that United game and the problem in the Napoli game, it was the midfield. The midfield is the real issue. Like, don't get me wrong, Trent's individual defending was poor. Van Dijk wasn't at his best in the game. But part of the issue is, obviously, when you've got guys running in behind that back line, you have to have pressure on the ball. You have to do it. And the midfield can't do it, especially when Milner's in it. Towards the end of last season, it looked like Milner was pretty much at the end of his usefulness, and Henderson was maybe approaching the end of his usefulness as well. And I think they thought to themselves, look, we weren't able to remake the front line when we wanted to because of COVID, so we've got to do it now. And that means that we might have to try and eke out another year with this midfield and then go big next year. Now, I think they were willing to make an exception for Tchouaméni because I think they thought he was available at below market rate. So they had a nibble at him. But as soon as the price got too tasty, they were like, right, fine, we'll just go again with the midfielders we've got. But the problem is Thiago and Fabinho are both great, especially Thiago, but they're injured all the time. Ox and Cater are genuinely injured all the time. And Milner and Henderson, especially Milner, just do not have the legs to do what they need to do anymore. Now, I'm not saying they're useless, but I saw Milner in the United game especially. I thought, this is a guy whose body can't keep up anymore. He was really trying to play the way he always has, where energy has been so much a part of his game, but there's only so far game reading can take you. And if they can't press in midfield, you're relying on the front line to do an awful lot of work, or you're relying on your defence to get it right again and again and again. And right now, that's not happening.
But isn't there that, I don't know about the truth of it, but that myth or that rumour or that story that it comes out every season that James Milner, for the past 10 seasons, has finished first in the pre-season fitness tests in every club he's been at?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, okay, he is old, but fitness surely isn't the problem there.
But it's not so much about fitness. It's more about whether you have the agility and things. So, for instance, I have no trouble believing that James Milner still has great stamina, but whether he has the ability to match a 24-year-old for pace over the first few yards, I don't know. Whether he has the ability to change direction, I don't know. And also, even just losing a couple of yards from season to season, right? Mm-hmm. can be a major difference in how you are able to press. And more importantly, Milner might be okay if you had Fabinho and Thiago playing with him at the same time. But when you've got Harvey Elliott playing there or Henderson playing with Milner as well, suddenly you're carrying too many guys in midfield because Harvey Elliott, really talented player, but doesn't show any signs of being a particularly defensively skillful player. That's not what he's in the team for. And Henderson doesn't have the legs either. So whenever you kind of see Milner on the pitch, you think, I want him to be surrounded by guys who can cover for the deficiencies that Milner has at this stage in his career. And I don't think Liverpool have had those guys available to them this season. And that, to me, is a really big problem, as is Nunez.
Yeah.
The Nunez situation. Okay.
Have you seen the latest video of him training?
Oh my God. Please talk us through this video because it is incredible.
So I'm not sure who has the ball, but there's a ball out at around left back. Nunez pressures them, completely bends them. Like it's not even close to the ball. Absolutely.
Packs him down.
Takes the ball, continues to play, takes it into the left-hand side of the box, no one around him, and then proceeds to put a shot pretty much out for a corner, right? Like, from what I saw, it was kind of like that angle. It was like the inverse of that angle Di Maria shot that went out for a corner. Like, you just see it fly across the pitch and just into the distance. The ball's still going.
And it's like, there's a guy in the box towards the end of it he could have crossed to. He, like you say, He could have taken it on like another 10.
I don't care about that.
He could have taken it on another 10 or 15 yards as well.
He's a professional footballer in training with no pressure on him. To make that level of contact in the ball is absolutely wild. And what else? The other thing I've seen on social media is like Liverpool fans calling for the charity shield Nunes to come back. That one goal he scored.
Yeah, that one goal he scored.
That one game he played in. They're like, yeah, he's better than Haaland.
Where they were like, oh yeah, he's going to be set. Yeah, I mean, look, the thing about Nunes is he is not a technical player. That's undeniable. But it has been kind of funny watching how Liverpool are kind of, I don't know, playing around him in some ways. Like, so I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and he's currently taking 7.7 shots a game, Nunez. Now, admittedly, there's very limited minutes, very limited minutes. But 7.7 shots a game is like hilarious. Obviously, it would be kind of like all time insane numbers. But do you know how many passes he's been completing a game so far?
4.
It's more than that, I'm afraid to say. It's 9.
Right.
9 passes a game. So essentially, this guy...
Per 90 or in his minutes?
Per 90. Right. So he's taking about 30 touches a game. So right now, a quarter of his touches are shots, which is pretty funny. And to be honest, he's been getting loads of shots from dangerous areas. Like, I do think he'll start scoring. But I kind of don't want him to now. We've all been waiting for Liverpool to miss on a major transfer for a while. And with Nunez, it at least feels that even if he is a good goal scorer, the problems he has technically might be so large that it really does pose a problem for them as a whole.
Well, yeah, I mean, essentially, with those numbers, all he is in their system is the end point to any attack ever.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if that decision is right or wrong, as soon as the ball gets to him, that's that attack finished. Once, you know, because he's going to take a shot, or he's going to give the ball away.
Yeah, that's like the Balotelli vortex.
Yeah.
Where, like, you used to give the ball to Balotelli and you just had to say, one way or another, this move ends with him. Either he scores or it goes out.
Yeah. Because also, if you think about that central role before with, like, Firmino, who was so integral in, like, linking up between that midfield and, their inside forwards, completely different team.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, when he had his good game this season, that's when they were great, and he's got like 3 goals and 3 assists so far, which it does show how much more fluid they are when he plays. Whereas when Nunez plays, you do see him get shots, but they just look a bit clunkier. But I don't know. Okay, the other thing I wanted to ask you about was, like, how much of this is on Klopp? Because right now, of course, everybody's talking about, like, the seventh season syndrome with Klopp, which I would kind of love to see. I would love to see it. Now, I've always been, like, a denier, a skeptic about it happening at Dortmund. I think they got unlucky that season. They ended up recovering. They finished seventh, you know. That I think their expected goal difference was, like, plus 20. They ended up with, like, a plus 5 actual goal difference. They were kind of fine. But if everyone starts believing it, it kind of feels like it will happen. And it is a difficult situation for Klopp.
Yeah, I was looking forward to this topic because I was thinking about it on the train home this evening. So I don't believe that there's a 7-year curse, right? But I do believe that there is a shelf life for every manager and every squad.
Yes, here we go.
And I think that the 7 year seems to be Klopp's, you know, his shelf life in terms of his squads then get apathetic after that. And I've used the word apathy quite a lot in this section so far. But if you think about Klopp's squad, the majority of them have been there for at least 4 or 5 of his 7 years, right? Mm-hmm. He's taken them to the pinnacle of football in Europe, right? that that kind of that back-to-back season, Champions League, then following on with the Premier League, right? Yeah. That like that that was the top of that cycle. Since then, there has been a slow but steady decline, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think if you think about it, like if it was in your profession, like in your job, your day-to-day job, if you went in for 7 years, did the same things, did the same drills, did the same, you know, same tactics, same formation, all that stuff is so similar. It becomes so repetitive that you can get apathetic and like you can start just kind of going through the motions, right? Everybody's so drilled into the club way that I think training, like your intensity can drop without you even knowing because you're like, oh, we're doing this again. I know I can do that. I can cut corners here. I can do this. Mm-hmm. I can do that. If you look at like pressure for positions, in a lot of positions, there isn't much. Like who's going to take Trent's position if he doesn't defend properly? Realistically, Trent's not going to get dropped. Van Dijk's not going to get dropped. Like I suppose there is a bit of competition in midfield, but ultimately the only reason there's competition in midfield is because nobody can stay fit. You're competing to be the best alternative. If Liverpool have a fully fit squad, that squad picks itself fairly easily, in my opinion.
This is a really good point.
And I think, like, if you're in that squad for this long, doing all the same things and having such, at least for a lot of the players, real security in their positions, it's quite hard to not become a bit apathetic and a bit and just take your foot off the gas a bit. And I can, and personally, that's what I see with this squad at the moment. I think it's reached its cycle and some of the players either need to move on or the manager needs to move on or just there just needs to be some form of refresh.
That's interesting, like, because I've heard people say a version of this, but I haven't heard it put as convincingly as that. I mean, because what you're saying is kind of the opposite of the people who are pinning a lot of this on the Mane departure, right? Because almost what you're saying here is if Klopp's going to stay, a bigger turnover is needed. You're going to have to drastically remake this squad, kind of Ferguson style, in order to create the new generation of it. Whereas obviously the narrative recently has been, well, Mane's gone, suddenly the attack doesn't look like it's at the races, despite the fact that Jota, when he's played since he joined Liverpool, has looked absolutely incredible. Firmino's obviously had a big impact this season. Even Nunez, you know, while he individually hasn't looked tremendous, when you look at Liverpool's output when he's played, they've still been good in attack. I mean, they're still second in the league by expected goals to Manchester City. It's been the defence that has let them down. They've got the sixth best defence by expected goals against. But I don't know. You would argue that Diaz and Elliot and Nunez, like, don't those guys surely want to be there and are excited to be there and they're going to have an effect. But in your eyes, the rest of the squad maybe is a bit jaded and doesn't have a reason to put their best foot forward.
I don't think it's not so much they don't have a reason to. I just think they're very comfortable in this current cycle. They're very comfortable in what this team is, in how this team plays, in their role in the team. The issue is that for a lot of those players, their role is a major starting role.
Yeah.
And I think to be as competitive, to keep up with the likes of City week in, week out, any form of, like, even if you're only at 90%, it's not good enough. And you're going to see over the course of the season, you're going to drop.
That's true.
And I don't know if that's Klopp's fault. I don't know if that's the player's fault. I don't know if it's both or neither, if it's just circumstance. But I just kind of feel that this Liverpool team will only get... They're not going to finish where they are now. They'll get better than they are this season, but I don't think they'll hit the heights that they've hit in the previous seasons. I think they are over the hill in terms of this cycle with Klopp.
Yeah.
Like, can you really see a couple more seasons out of that midfield?
No, I think they're going to have to go and get a stellar midfielder next summer, but I look at them and I think, okay, they're heavily linked with Bellingham. If they go and get Bellingham next summer, I don't have major concerns. You know, then I still think, like you say, the best 11 picks itself. And even at 75, 80% effort, I'd still back them over Arsenal or Spurs or Chelsea.
Yeah, but I think it's one thing being better than them. It's another thing being... Because, right, this is the thing. This is another thing I wanted to get on to. Is Klopp's time at Liverpool, could it be considered as a failure?
No.
I think it could be in a sense, right?
I think not winning the Champions League last year is a bit of a failure, if I'm honest.
I mean as a whole, right?
Sure, but I mean, like, if they'd won that Champions League,
yeah, okay, right, yeah,
I don't think you'd be able to ask this question. And
yeah, probably not. No, I wouldn't. But my this is the thing, right? Klopp has undeniably built one of the best squads in the Premier League history, right?
Sure.
Like, undeniably. But when you break it down, right? We touched on this 2 weeks ago. His win rate in the Premier League is 61%, just this under 61%, right?
This is fucking controversial stuff. This is spicy stuff.
And if you look at the trophy cabinet, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has one Champions League,
yeah,
one Premier League, right? Club World Cup and a League Cup, but no one really cares.
Yeah, no one cares.
Fundamentally, right? He has one Champions League and one Premier League, right? Which those are two incredibly hard competitions to win. So credit where credit's due. However, Thomas Tuchel in 2 years did all of those but the Premier League. Obviously, that's a big omission. But if you're looking at the greatest squads of the last 25 years, like the Premier League era, that falls some way short for how good that squad actually is in terms of silverware. And okay, yeah, you can say they've come up against another all-time squad in City.
Yeah.
And they've fallen short to that. And I suppose they've been unfortunate in that sense. But if you look at United's treble winning team, that was the start of three Premier Leagues in a row.
Mm-hmm.
There was three Premier Leagues in the mid-noughties as well in a row. Arsenal, Invincibles, and a double. Like a back-to-back league titles, wasn't it, in the early noughties?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think so. No, we definitely had a couple of doubles in there, but yeah. I mean, 03, 04, I don't know if we won it back-to-back then.
I just think, for as good as this squad is, undeniably an amazing squad, if Klopp was to leave at the end of the season and to just have, and I say just, this is a big just, but to just have a Premier League and a Champions League with that squad, I think that's a bit of a disappointment with how good that squad is.
Okay. There's a reasonable point in there, I think, in the quite often when we've been asked about, you know, player for player, for the last kind of 4 years, my attitude has been player for player, Liverpool do have the best team in the world. They do. There are obviously positions they're weaker than other great sides, but, you know, I would have taken Robertson, Van Dijk, Alisson, Salah, and now Thiago over pretty much anybody in the world in their positions. And I suppose you do then have to be judged on that. But I would also say that part of what Klopp's done at Liverpool is build that squad and get Liverpool taken seriously again. Now, I know that kind of feels a bit wishy-washy, but when he took over, you know, my memory very recently, really, in the last 10 years, Liverpool were finishing mid-table, level on points with Fulham, and had managers like Roy Hodgson, and he's a good manager, and so is Brendan Rodgers, but they're not, you know, coveted by the biggest clubs, right, in the world. Exactly. Yeah. So I think restoring them to that kind of echelon of football counts as an achievement for Klopp as well. Not just Klopp, but partially Klopp.
Yeah.
However,
I mean, a lot of that is their amazing backroom staff, though, isn't it? Sure.
But he's played a part in it. And like, it doesn't matter whether they buy the right players if Klopp can't put it together in some way, but sure. I don't know, man. I think I'm not sure you can call it a failure. If they'd been getting kind of 84, 85 points during that period, I might be there with you. But when you're getting 90 plus points and you still don't win the title, sometimes you do just have to hold your hands up and say, like, what are we going to do?
Yeah, and I agree. And I'll say that the word failure is definitely a harsh word to use in this scenario. But I don't know. If I just kind of think, part of me, if I was Jurgen Klopp, and say I leave Liverpool at the end of the season, I would look back on that in a you know, after an appropriate amount of time and be like, we should have won more silverware. That squad was good enough to win more silverware. And so, yeah, perhaps failure is too harsh a word to use, but I think so a bit of an underwhelming tenure based on just only based on how good that squad he built is.
Well,
that's my argument.
I guess that most managerial spells tend to end disappointingly just because that's normally when you'd move on, when things aren't going as well.
Well, it's not so much just the end. I mean, you like the tenure as a whole.
Sure, but I don't think that... But if, for instance, they had built towards this and in his second to last... Say he leaves at the end of this year, but last year he'd won the Champions League and then this year he won the Premier League. You know, like he hadn't won them before, but he did those things at the end of his tenure. I think we'd look at the tenure very differently from it seemingly peaking and then going down again.
I mean, perhaps, but the numbers are still the same in terms of major trophies versus seasons, right?
Sure, but I think that our attitude to his work will be coloured by the way it's progressed. I mean, the question is, where do they end up this season? If they still finish second and they put in a decent show in the Champions League, and they could still win the Champions League, like, it's definitely not impossible, then... suddenly we're talking about Klopp very differently. But if they get a tough draw, they go out in the Champions League quarterfinals and they finish below second in the Prem, that starts to concern me, because I look at them and I think this, they should still be finishing second in the league.
It kind of seems like a scenario where you're just waiting for them to come good, right?
Yeah,
it seems like it's a ship that's just going to right itself at one point.
Yeah,
and I agree. They are a top two team in the Premier League by squad. Well, no, by a distance. You know, I don't really think there. I think there is still a decent gap between City and Liverpool, or at least on paper, between City and Liverpool and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But fuck Liverpool, right? Well, you know what I mean, right? Right.
Where do you think they'll finish? Totally honestly, where do you think they'll finish?
I think they'll probably finish second, right? It'll be City, then Liverpool, right? This is just it's just a bad patch. It just has to happen. It seems to have happened at the start of the season. You know, teams go through bad patches every season.
Mm-hmm.
They're too good. Like, they're definitely not going to finish outside the top four. There's absolutely no way of that. Maybe they could finish third. I don't know.
I think it's possible.
It's possible, but... I mean, my heart says they'll finish fifth, right? But my head says second, right?
Jesus.
I'm just wishing them to drop it.
I mean, it would be pretty funny. And all it takes, actually, is one of these teams to get hot, right? Like, Arsenal don't...
Well, Arsenal started amazingly.
Yeah, though Arsenal have had an easy schedule. But, like...
Yeah.
If Arsenal or Spurs are pretty good, as in, like, not that much worse than Liverpool, and also get lucky... here and there, then it's very easy for one of them to finish above Liverpool, given the start Liverpool have had.
But the difference is Arsenal and Spurs are playing much, much closer to their top level of ability from
that
squad.
That's probably true, yeah.
Liverpool are playing considerably lower than what they could be.
Yeah.
So you're thinking once that switch turns... and those tides turn and Liverpool start playing as they have done in the past four seasons.
Yeah.
That gap becomes much, much harder to manage for the teams that are also vying for Champions League football, other than City.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. Don't get me wrong, I would love to see the wheels come off. The whole league has been bitch slapped by this club for long enough.
I would love it to be like an absolutely catastrophic season. Just rumour after rumour, lost the dressing room, Klopp's going to leave, Salah's refusing to play, everything, throw the kitchen sink at them. inject it.
A Okay, so moving on from Liverpool, I wanted to talk to you about Antoine Griezmann at Atletico Madrid, because I feel like the week in shithousery should really be your kind of favourite way of engaging with football. And this is kind of incredible. Like, I'm not sure I've seen a multi-million dollar entity devote itself to trolling another one, like, so heartily as Atletico have done. So here's the situation. Antoine Griezmann is on loan from Barcelona at Atletico Madrid. If he plays more than 50% of the minutes over the 2 years he's on loan, Atleti have to pay $40 million to make it permanent. He played about 80% of minutes last year. So now Simeone is trying to bring that average down. And the way he's doing that is by only bringing Griezmann on after the 60th minute of Atletico Madrid games. So these are the times he's come on so far this season. The 62nd minute, 62nd, 64th, 63rd, 61st, 63rd, 62nd. I mean, this is, it's very clearly a money-saving enterprise. I'm not quite sure why Griezmann's going along with it, because it's kind of embarrassing for him. But this is amazing, especially because it fucks over Barcelona, which is one of my favourite things to see in football.
I imagine, well, firstly, it is immense shithousery. I respect it so much. But surely Griezmann's going along with it because he has this soft spot for Atleti, right? This is, you know, purely conjecture, but I would assume he would side with Atleti over Barca if he was choosing, like, allegiances.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. So, also, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes in Barca, but it seems like a fairly toxic scenario at the minute.
Sure.
So, you know, when like, Frankie de Jong has £17 million worth of, you know, unpaid wages, you know, like, shit's going on behind that. So I can't imagine Barcelona's the best club to be at the minute. So I think, sure, like, I think he understands the situation. And considering his position with Atleti and his soft spot for them, I think it's not ideal. But also, like, what's his other option?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I kind of wanted him at the end of this loan to go back to Barcelona because his contract runs until 2024. And it'd be really funny for them to have to pay the insane wages they gave him when they signed him. But inevitably, they're not going to do that. They're going to find some way around it, or they'll negotiate a wage reduction. And then later on, they'll give him, you know, shares of something. So from that point of view, I can understand why he would help Atleti increase their leverage, because that's what's happening here, right? It's not like Atleti don't want to keep him. They know that Barca need to move him because Barca want this cash from Atletico Madrid, and Barca need this contract ended, these wages gone. So I assume that Griezmann is also probably angling for his own payout, which is, you know, maybe Atleti say, well, look, if we can do a deal at 20 million instead of 40 million with Barcelona, we will give you 5 or 10 of the million that we don't have to pay Barca. Because I do think it is a little bit humiliating to just be brought on at 60 minutes like a youngster. It's a bit, I don't know, I find that a little bit demeaning.
I mean, I suppose I hadn't actually considered it that much from Griezmann's perspective,
right?
You know, in terms of, like, what that, like, how that felt for him, considering he is actually one of the, you know, the top forwards in Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
On his day. But I still love it. Fuck Barca.
Yeah, I mean, fuck Barca.
But this is the thing, right? Barca are being held over a barrel, because it's the same thing as why, you know, United end up paying £80 million for Harry Maguire. They're in such a position of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
People know they can take advantage. So why wouldn't Atletico do this?
But, well, it's the sort of thing that you think, oh, it would be funny if a club did that, but the club never actually follows through on it. The fact Atleti are doing it is really a kind of salt the earth strategy. It is so extreme to do it, because it's also not like they're really winning their games. They haven't been great so far this season. They're out of the Champions League spots right now. They haven't been playing well. They could use more minutes from Griezmann.
But also, how much of this do you think is like a middle finger to Barcelona?
Oh, I think it 100% is, right?
Behaviour in the past year for a club that size is awful.
I literally cannot believe that there are people who defend Barcelona's business practices online. I get if you're a Barcelona fan,
yeah,
but I really don't understand why people think it's okay for an employer to pressure an employee to reduce their wages, for them to go, and they're like, oh, there's nothing wrong with asking Frankie de Jong if he'll reduce his wages. Yes, there is. You shouldn't be allowed to do that.
There was also
that's why unions exist.
Yeah, there was also allegations they threatened legal action over the fact that the contract he was offered was illegal.
Oh my God.
And all that stuff. And it's like,
oh yeah, where they were like, actually, this was bullshit. Yeah, but the thing, it was like the illegality was on their side, right? They were like, the people who gave you this contract, who were Barcelona employees at the time, were acting illegally. And yeah, it's like, that doesn't mean that I don't get the money. That means you get sued. They're so stupid. When I see Barcelona do stuff and I think, it's one of those things where you go through a period of time where you second guess yourself and you think there must be something here that I'm not seeing or understanding, because it cannot make sense for such an enormous entity to be behaving in this manner. Yeah. They must have smarter advice than this. But no, they've been doing it for so long that it's very clear at this point that Barcelona have no brainstem connected to the hands doing things.
But I think there's also a fundamental shortcoming in regulatory bodies that Barcelona can be allowed to go out and buy Lewandowski while they still owe Frankie de Jong £17 million.
Yeah.
The fact that they've been allowed, and also I think this is part of the reason why Atleti are taking such a stance in the fact that Barca are this European giant, and they just seem, as a lot of things in football seem to be, that if you're powerful, you just seem to be able to brush a lot of shit under the carpet.
Yeah. Yeah. I for one, I don't know. Maybe I would be sad if Barcelona just kind of ceased to exist as a football club. But there's a part of me that thinks we actually do need a serious lesson here for clubs. Like, it needs to be understood that you can't just run up debts forever.
You can't just do what you want. Yeah. I do think that the next couple of seasons for Barcelona are really integral to where they are, how the club actually runs for the next, if it runs for the next decade or so. Because the amount of stuff in that club they've leveraged at the minute, and they've given up this season with their whole like media and the rights to their selling off, like loads of that.
Yeah, yeah.
To, if they don't achieve short-term success, they'll be in a really, really tough place as a club.
But that's the thing, and they could easily not get that because they're up against a team who won the Champions League and the title last year. Like, they've made a bunch of short-term moves. And if they don't win anything in the next two seasons, then you say, well, this hasn't safeguarded the financial future of the club. In fact, it's made it worse. It hasn't delivered a trophy. In fact, in the long term, it's got you further away from being able to compete. And you could just get, you know, 15 years of Real Madrid dominance. When we say this stuff, I think people think it's alarmist. And I get that because it has been shown time and time again that big clubs can essentially do what they want, get away with things, run up huge debts, continue to exist, get bailed out. But the scale of the debt that Barcelona have run up is staggering.
It's never quite to this extent. It's never to this extent.
And their assets
are depreciating. It's also never so like brazen either.
Yeah.
This seems a lot more brazen and open than any other big club I've ever witnessed come close to that.
Yeah. I think a comeuppance is more than due here.
I genuinely think if they don't have major success, a major trophy in the next 2 to maybe 3 seasons, there are some huge issues with the longevity of that club and that stat, like the stature of it is at the top of Europe.
Damn. File this under shit that I love to see. All right, so next up is the burn book. Now, in this segment each week, Pete and I put one thing we hate into the burn book, and one thing we surprisingly didn't hate, we take out of the burn book. Honestly, it's kind of hard to find stuff that we don't hate normally. I really struggled this week. Pete, Should we start with one thing you did hate? What are you putting into the burn book this week? We might have the same thing.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
All of mine are quite niche.
Oh, okay, maybe not then.
I have multiple ones. So I've actually started a note on my phone called Burn Book Tracker. Because the things I find that I hate happen so regularly, but they're often quite fleeting and I forget about them.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a way to track. And the one I'm going to put in this week is unnecessary storage containers for things that already have containers.
You are going to have to spell this out.
That's fine. So, picture this. You buy a...
Oh, my God.
You buy some... You go to the supermarket and you buy some spaghetti, some dry spaghetti.
Sure.
It comes in its own container. Mm-hmm. It comes in its little packet. You open the packet, you take spaghetti out, you put the packet back. Might even put a little bit of a clip-it on it if you want to keep it, you know, all in there. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Why then do people feel the need to buy things like mason jars?
Yeah.
And then decant said contents from one container that's perfectly fine into a different, more expensive
container. Jar that says spaghetti, for example.
I know it's spaghetti, right? I can understand it if it's on show, right? I can get it. It looks a bit nicer. All the ones in our house are in the pantry behind closed doors. The only people who ever see them, me and Jess.
Uh-huh.
But there's at least 15 of them.
Okay.
So for rice, for flour, for spaghetti, everything that comes in a container is put in a different container and then put in the pantry.
This is such a... You are not wrong that this is niche. This is such a weird thing to be pissed off about. I get what you're saying. And I do think that some of this comes down to people with time on their hands going on Pinterest or whatever and thinking, maybe I'd be happier if instead of my sugar coming in the pack that it comes in, I put it in a little ceramic jar that says sugar that has like a wooden spoon with it that you use to disseminate
the
sugar.
I'm fine with that because that sits on the counter and that's useful, right? These jars... These jars are in a drawer. They're in a pantry cupboard.
Are they actually, though? I thought this is for the sort of people who keep their pasta on the surface.
This is the thing, right? If it was like that, I could understand it because it's more aesthetic.
Okay.
There's a point to that. So my annoyance isn't with storing them in the jar. My annoyance is with the fact that it's irrelevant and redundant.
Okay.
They're put into a nice jar and it's like, that looks really... You know, that looks more aesthetic than a crumpled up spaghetti packet.
Okay.
I accept that. But then they're put behind a cupboard door nobody else who doesn't live in the house sees.
But when you open... Okay. But when you open a drawer or a cupboard in your house and it's a mess, does this not stress you out in some way? Because I just had to clear out my bedside drawers and I still look at it and I think... I wish that everything here had a slot that was exactly the right size for it that it could go in. But it pisses me off that there's just loose stuff in here.
I don't think it's too... I don't think there... It only exists in the two extremes, though. Okay, it's not like we're casting strands of spaghetti into the pantry on its own. It's like they will still be organized to an extent. Like the packet of silly will be there and the packet of spaghetti will be there, but they come in their own packet, so it's
fine. I assume you're not like putting it in as like loose strands of spaghetti. Yeah.
What pasta are we having tonight? Let's find out. Scoop it out and see what we get.
Just put your arm in the drawer and like sweep it into a pot.
No, it's not like that, but like there will be an element of organization regardless. Why does it need to be in this special little glass jar?
Well, also because glass jars aren't really stackable or anything. I would understand if it were kind of regular shaped things that you could stack up and it was easy, you know. But I always find it weird that we put all our spices in these little cylindrical containers, you know, these little glass things that don't tessellate properly, So they're in the drawer and there's loads of unused space around them because they're all fucking circular when you see them from above. There's so much useless space. Oh, it drives me insane. Oh my God.
The only ones
that,
in our
that
house,
is annoying.
The only ones in our house that are actually useful are the ones for floor. And that's because for some reason, Jess bought 36 kilograms of floor during the pandemic.
Well, we know why that was, right? Because she correctly assumed that she was going to do a lot of baking.
Yeah, but no, no, it was more. No, it was more that the company only did 12 kilogram bags.
Yeah, but was it? But
and
it
she
was
bought
like
three. She bought three different types.
That's mental.
We're still working through them.
But there was this. But I know you got some double zero, right? So you could make pizza or pasta. Was that what that was for?
I'll be honest. I don't know the difference between the flours. I just know that there are three types, and they were all 12 kilogram bags.
Oh my God! I mean, sure. Well, oh God. Yeah, I mean, it's just about grade, and I understand why you would get double zero. I bought double zero so I could make pizza at home during the pandemic. But yeah, okay. I think that this is very specific to your living situation.
It kind of just feels like a bit of a dig at Jess, right?
Yeah, this does just feel like we're bitching about our wives.
She also wasn't happy about the podcast 2 weeks ago when I said that she listened to it. She skipped past all the football stuff. But
yeah, so did Emma.
Rest.
Same thing.
She wanted me to to make it known that while she did pour red wine all over my Comme des Garçons, she then replaced them with a new pair.
Yeah.
I didn't mention the fact that she replaced them, just that she ruined them.
I don't care. I feel like if anything that takes away from the story. But it's funny that she made you do it, that you've had we're on episode 2 and we're already on our first on-air apology.
Yeah, a redaction.
Yeah, exactly. A correction. The thing I hated this week that I'm putting in the burn book is the queue to see the Queen and all the discourse around the queue. I hate it so much. I hate it so much. There were so many people who were like, this is the most British thing ever, blah, blah, blah. Like people queuing up for literally days on end to see the Queen. And, you know, after the Queen died, I was quite surprised. I thought that people were more normal than I expected. I sort of thought the whole country would lose its mind. And corporations and brands lost their minds, especially on Twitter. You know, like, you had, like, Anne Summers being like, RIP.
Oh, my God, I saw that on Twitter. That was
kind
mental.
Of original girl boss stuff, basically, like, female-led. But it's... But I thought that the average person had been more normal than I expected. But then I think the queue became its own thing. The fact that it got to like 7 miles long or something, there was 3 miles of it just in Southwark Park. Southwark Park is so far away from Westminster. I couldn't believe it. So but also I was just kind of like, I take great pride in not being particularly British, but I do still live here and I do still have this accent. And it's annoying when this country is so obviously a pastiche of itself that it's incredibly easy for people from other places to take the piss. And I was just like, can it not be that everybody's queuing through the night for days on end to pay their respects to the Queen? Because that is genuine, like, peasant shit. That's like feudal serf behavior.
Do you think she was actually in that coffin? Because I don't. I personally think it, just in terms of like security risk, I think that's just a figurative coffin.
It's a stunk coffin.
Coffin. Just my opinion. I think it's just a decoy coffin.
Oh my God. I mean, they do have a lot of staff guarding it, right? What did you think? What like the risk is in what of terrorism or something?
Well, I don't know. They seem to be guarding it pretty close. So they're obviously concerned about it. it's a monarch hasn't died in what 70 plus years, obviously.
70 years, yeah.
Yeah.
71, I guess.
I don't know. If I was chief of security running that, I'd be like, maybe we just put the box there and close it. No one will know. And then just keep the other box.
Yeah, but you're not answering my question, which is...
I'm saying box and coffin.
Yeah. And you're not answering my question, which is, what do you think they're afraid of? That someone will nick the body?
Well, no, not so much that. More kind of like some form of attack.
But it's a target,
terrorism or otherwise, right?
But it's a target for an attack, whether or not the Queen's body's in the coffin.
Yes, right? but if you... No, but this is the thing. If you do the attack and the Queen's not there, the attack still happens anyway, but then the Queen's corpse is still fine.
So she's like... yeah, it's like when Gary comes back to the Team America headquarters, you know? They like, the terrorists think they've won, but actually they're like, the Queen survived this in a way. Not in a literal way, but in a kind of figurative way. Okay, interesting. Well, look, regardless of whether the Queen was in her coffin or not, I found the whole thing really demoralizing and just like a stupid parody of Britishness. And I thought the way that Brits love that really gets on my tits. I found all the Paddington Bear stuff really tedious as well. I was like, Paddington Bear and the Queen were never connected before this year. They only became connected this year due to a sketch for the Queen's, whatever it was, Jubilee, Platinum Jubilee. Like, there's never been a connection between them before, except in the sense that they both represent a kind of nostalgic idea of how Britain once was or should be. But people were leaving marmalade sandwiches outside Buckingham Palace gates, which obviously is going to attract rats because this is London. But like, I don't know. It's just, I hate it when people do this knowing shit. I hate it when it's twee as well. Like, it's like, have you ever been to a wedding where somebody who very clearly has no interest in poetry has inexplicably decided that their speech or their vows are going to rhyme?
Personally, no.
But you know what I mean, that phenomenon where people are like, I've got to make this rhyme. And I just think, why? That tweeness... One of the things that my wife and I bonded over really early is that we think the same stuff is fucking lame. We hate the same things. And having that shared instinct for what is insufferable, I think is so important to a relationship.
Oh, fully. although I hate so many things that the fact that Jess just hates some of them means that we have enough common ground.
Sure. I think one week maybe we should get our partners to give their burn book items, and we can try and sell them to one another.
Yeah, as in what, about ourselves?
No,
I imagine it'd be about me.
Oh, really? It would just all be stuff that Jess hates about you.
I imagine it'll be high on the list. Yeah, I think when you spend this much time with someone, that rises to the top, right?
Should we move on to stuff we didn't hate? What have you got that you didn't hate that you would like to take out of the burn book?
So the thing this week that I didn't hate was David Attenborough's Frozen Planet is back, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Have you watched it?
I watched the first episode.
Yeah. So I watched episode 2 this week.
Okay.
And as a series, it's just amazing, right? The way it's shot, it's just... top to bottom, it's one of my favourite shows, right? But it was made even better this week because my cat, Taco, also appears to love Frozen Planet.
What?
So we have an L sofa in our living room, and he generally sits at the bottom of the L, up like at my feet, but that's the bit closest to the TV.
Okay.
And very occasionally he'll like rest his chin on the armrest.
Oh my God.
And that means his eyes are directly at the TV. And he actually does quite like TV to an extent. But with this, for some reason, I assume it's because of all the animals and all the kind of like amazing cinematic shots and the colors. Of the 60-minute episode, I reckon he was fully watching about 40 minutes of it.
Oh my God.
Like, he just sat there and just watched it with us.
Oh, that's so cute.
To the extent where I was watching him as much as I was watching the episode. So like he would watch it for like 10 minutes straight and then go for like a 3-4 minute nap.
Were there moments in the episode where he seemed particularly engaged? Were there fish or something?
Yeah, I think he actually particularly liked the polar bear section.
Oh, and, that's surprising.
And the seal section. He seemed particularly engaged in those. There wasn't so much fish in this. Well, I suppose there were whales. Yeah, well, yeah, he liked the whales too, but not as much as the kind of like land creatures, particularly the polar bears.
That's so cute. Oh my God. I mean, this is a very wholesome thing to bring.
It's the only thing I could pick this week, genuinely.
All right.
Like, it was the only thing I had this week. But yeah, particularly for a cat to just sit and watch 40 minutes of a program, I thought was mental.
Yeah.
And like, I don't mean like partially like glancing at it. I mean, like he watched it like we watched it.
Yeah, because normally they'd just fall asleep.
Yeah.
Like Sushi would sit with us to watch a thing, but he would just go to sleep.
Yeah, and that's what I assumed he would do, but then he just stayed away. He just stayed engaged with it. It was mental.
This is genuinely adorable. This is genuinely adorable. My thing taking out the burn book is not as good as this. I watched the first episode of House of the Dragon finally, and I was kind of like, this is going to be some nerdy shit. I'm not into this. I'm too cool for this. I thought it was really good. I thought it was genuinely really good. Like, I don't know. I'm really anti-prequel, generally. I don't know why you'd want to do prequels. I don't understand it with the Lord of the Rings one, which we might actually come on to in the bonus episode. But I don't get this idea of, let's tell a story about the origin of these characters who you've met before, and you kind of know where they're all going to end up. I think that's such a weird corner to paint yourself into creatively. This show doesn't do that. It starts like, you know, a couple of hundred years before Game of Thrones. But I just thought, oh, are we going to just be hearing about who wants to be the king again? I don't give a shit. But then watching it, I thought, there is something very, very engrossing about how it's done. I like the kind of core intrigue of it. I think it's I could do without the dragons. In my view, they should bin the dragons from Game of Thrones. The dragons should be
what, and it'd just be House of the House of the
yeah, and you'd be really confused. You'd look at it and you'd be like, is this te, like the French word for tea, like what is this? But I don't know, I think Game of Thrones would be more interesting if there were no dragons. And all the dragon bones, it was like, you know, dinosaurs, where they were kind of like, I guess these creatures lived, you know, thousands of years ago, and they built up a whole kind of mythology around them, but they weren't actually real, because I don't want to see the fucking dragons flying. I don't want to see people getting on the dragons. I don't want to see the CGI that I feel like they always kind of half-ass when it comes to the dragons. I as soon as the dragons appear, I'm like, oh God, here we go.
On the CGI, I don't like CGI in House of the Dragon.
I think it's so lame, and it's just like, it's too Warhammer-y, man. I'm just like, I can't be doing with this.
But what did you expect?
I know.
So you're saying you liked it and you're taking it out of the burn book, but you're also saying you fundamentally dislike probably one of the largest parts of it.
Yeah, basically. I'm saying right. That whenever a dragon was on scene, I'm pretty certain I said, oh, Jesus, here we go again with these fucking dragons. Like, they're so lame. And they have to speak a made up language at the dragons, because the dragons are like fucking Portuguese or something. Like, shut up, man. I just don't want there to be dragons. I just bin the dragons. They're lame. And in Game of Thrones, I felt like the longer Game of Thrones went on, the more fan service-y it got. And then later on, it was just like, there are zombies and the zombies are fighting dragons and there's also a zombie dragon. And I was just like, I feel like I'm paying Dungeons and Dragons, which I don't want to do, because again, I'm cool, Pete. So I was just like, nah, I'm not feeling this. But anyway, I think the show overall did a good job of overcoming a lot of my issues. And I think part of that's down to the quality of actor they've got in it. You know, Matt Smith is a great actor. Paddy Considine is a great actor. There's loads of good acting in it. And that really does go a long way to getting you past your reservations, because those people can be taken seriously while saying the word dragon. But at the same time, as soon as I saw a dragon, I was like, no, I'm absolutely out. Bin this shit. Fuck this dragon.
Are you coming back for episode 2?
Yeah, like, I mean, I would happily have watched it more, but my wife went to New York and she'll murder me if she comes back and I've watched more without her. So I'm stuck this week with absolutely nothing to watch. I can't watch Frozen Planet. I can't watch the Lord of the Rings show. I can't watch House of the Dragon. There's literally nothing I'm allowed to watch because my wife's away. I'm watching YouTube. It's unbelievable. I've been reduced. All right. That brings us to the end of the Burn Book this week. And that brings us to the end of the public episode. We're going to move over to the bonus episode. I think we might talk a little bit about the Lord of the Rings show, but that we'll be taking your questions on football and, of course, having our anything but football questions and discussion too. If you would like to get access to our bonus episodes, then head to patreon.com/patrickvs and subscribe at the $6 level, and we will see you over there. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.